From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Thank you very much for joining us. Today we're talking about racism as a public health crisis, and it's an interesting conversation. It's part of more than a year's now worth of coordinated programming and conversations around the book Waking Up White, which has been which a number of people in our region have been reading and discussing. And joining me to talk about this subject and the broader work of the La Crosse Waking Up White Collaborative and all of the efforts that are going on there are two guests. Diana Diaz-Granados is with Better Together in La Crosse County and is also part of the co-leader team of creating a healthier multicultural community. Diana, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers again.
Thank you for having me.
And we've got Alyssa Gostanczyk, who is with career services at Viterbo University and is also a member of the La Crosse Waking Up White Steering Committee. Alyssa, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So let's start with we'll get some more general information about not only the regional read but the White Privilege Symposium that's coming up. There are interesting book talks along the way that I know people will be interested in hearing about. We can find out about all of those things as today's program goes on. The subject at hand we drew from one of those upcoming talks, and it is racism as a public health crisis. Diana, how is it that we can consider racism from the perspective of public health?
Thanks, Ezra, for the question. So often when we hear racism, we think of individual actions, you know, bigotry, hearing someone use a racial slur. But what we need to be doing is thinking about the system that creates and impacts a person's health, their social kind of social place in their community, that impacts their economic stability, and recognize that it is some of our history, how our systems have been built that impact those outcomes, and that when we look at our data by race, we see disparities. And that's what the County Board of Supervisors looked at here in La Crosse County back in April when they declared and almost unanimously voted to declare racism a public health crisis in La Crosse County.
So that's a local body looking at data. What sort of data did they look at to make that determination?
When we look at, and certainly any of your listeners can look at countyhealthrankings.org, we looked at child poverty, and we see, like, if we think about for all of our children under the age of 18, about 10% of children live in poverty. But when we look at that data by race, we see that that children that identify as Black or African American are three times at that percentage. 34% of them live in poverty, and those numbers are equally or almost as high for our Hispanic population, our Native population, and that's really worrisome. When we look at low birth weight, and that impacts a person's health for the rest, can impact a person's health for the rest of their lives. We look at housing, and La Crosse County did a study on this of home ownership. We see disparities in between white population and our Black population. And we need to look at, why is that?
So when you look at something of, let's just say home ownership, since it's a thing that I think many people can relate to, the desire to own a home eventually, to create the generational wealth that can come along with that. And certainly anybody who's been paying attention sees disparities not only in our area but across the country. With the way Black Americans and other people of color have access to homeownership as compared to their white counterparts in our society. And yet a lot of people are going to look at that correlation and are associating it with racism, as with a racist system as part of this discussion, and might push back at that by saying, how do we know that that is the result of racism or evidence of racism rather than just the way it happens to be?
I think that is an easy way to kind of ignore the problem, that we blame people on their individual behaviors and have not been taught or have not learned about the practices of either redlining or, you know, La Crosse County was a sundown town that discouraged or really forbade our Black neighbors from being within our city our city area. We forget that there were government laws that discouraged or promoted racist practices within giving out home loans, that Black Americans that served in our armed forces were not afforded the possibility of having the GI Bill. And that sets up, and that, you know, those programs were created to set up the middle class that we have today.
All of these things that white families in our area have taken for granted, really, many generations now, have not been available to many of our neighbors.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a common saying that people just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But when a portion of our society has not ever even been allowed to buy boots or wear boots, then they have been at a disadvantage for far too long. And we need to look at those systems, look at and how to kind of repair that and reconceive how we can make our communities more equitable so that everyone can succeed.
It's an interesting continuation of that bootstraps analogy, indeed. That's Diana Diaz-Granados, who's with us today. Diana is with Better Together in La Crosse County and is also a leader on the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community, easy for me to say, Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community part of the group that's been promoting the regional read and Waking Up White and everything that we're talking about today. Alyssa Gostanzik is with us as well. Alyssa is with Viterbo University and is a member of the La Crosse Waking Up White Steering Committee. Alyssa, your profession isn't necessarily in public health. Is your affiliation with this group kind of the first time that you've considered racism from that public health perspective?
It absolutely is, Ezra, and I'm thinking about casting a wider net. My affiliation with this group is really the first time that I've reflected on racism through any lens, whether through privilege, public health, socioeconomic status, generational wealth, all of those things that prior to 2019, I was not at all engaged in this kind of work. And so I think that my involvement in this learning and growing and lifting up of other voices is really a testament to how you don't have to have a role that's specific to this. You don't have to have it be, quote, your job to be involved in this kind of work, that it really is the responsibility of all people to take time to reflect and figure out how they've gotten where they've gotten and what kinds of privileges attribute to that, what kind of systems have contributed to those successes.
It's interesting, and I want to ask you more about coming to this sort of through your own personal experience of learning about these things. But it's relevant for this conversation, and so I'll point out in a way that we usually don't during radio interviews. But since people can't see any of us, I'm gonna give everyone the opportunity to just identify how you prefer to have people understand your racial identity. I'll go first. I'm white and born and raised in La Crosse. Alyssa, I gather from what you were saying that you similarly would self-identify as a white American.
Yes, that's correct.
And Diana, I don't want to assume anything about you, but how do you identify in terms of your racial heritage?
I am the daughter of immigrants. I am of Latino ethnicity.
And again, it's not usually something that we bring up on this program, but it is relevant for this discussion, for what we're talking about today. Alyssa, you talked about, in particular, not having considered racism from really any perspective. Talk about what that experience has been like to learn, what that journey has been like for you during the time that you've been affiliated with the group.
Absolutely. So I first want to point out that having the ability to not even think about race is 100% privilege, right? So the fact that I don't need to think about the color of my skin and how I navigate the world on a hourly, daily, weekly basis is really worth pointing out. And I think prior to reading the book, Waking Up White by Debbie Irving, I didn't think of white as a race, which I think is very common, that it was for me, just that's the default, and any race that wasn't white was quote different. And that is as a result of upbringing, education, not going the extra mile to do my own kind of research into that. I think that that's something that many of our listeners perhaps can identify with when they fill out a survey or fill out something that requires their demographic. They may think, wow, well, white, that's a race, huh? And then just move on to the age or gender question. So in this journey, which as I mentioned, started in 2019, was really the result of happenstance. I did not necessarily seek this out. It was the work around the White Privilege Symposium and the Regional Read and the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community was brought to my attention via the La Crosse Martin Luther King Jr. celebration that happens in January. Just so happened that they had a table in the lobby after that presentation, and they were looking for people to help plan an event. And since my natural inclination is event planning, I thought, yeah, sure, I can help with that. Having no idea that this was going to be a multi-year life-changing kind of experience. And so it's been really amazing. The people that I've gotten to know through this work, like Diana, we are now co-facilitators in those book chats, but I previously didn't know Diana. I've gotten to know Thomas Harris a lot better at UWL, and just a variety of people of color, as well as white people who are dedicated to doing this work. And so being around folks that challenge you in a way that helps you to see that perhaps what you have been taught or what you thought is not 100% true. And that's not necessarily because it's not true through my experience as a white person, but just in general, to only have that one-sided view of life and then be able to talk with other people and see, oh, I really appreciate you sharing your perspective. You know, I'd never thought of something that way. Thank you for sharing how redlining or how a look or locking your door as someone walks by or something like that, that kind of continuous experience in a body of color that can't escape that, and how that really affects the quality of life, which I think brings it back to this public health conversation. So the CDC defines public health as the science of protecting and improving the health of people in their communities. And this work is achieved by promoting healthy lifestyles. And I think that healthy lifestyle includes all of those areas that Diana just mentioned, that it's not just physically going to the doctor, right? But it's access to education, housing, information about healthcare, the ability to be able to afford healthy food, all of those kinds of pieces that are not necessarily accessible to folks here in La Crosse and across the state of Wisconsin.
Diana, back to the issue of how different people's experiences are even within our own community. Talk about this idea of systemic racism and how it affects the broader aspects of public health. There are areas of our population where people experience poor health outcomes because of poverty, because of lack of education, and you know, white people as well. But how are those parts of our community that are negatively affected in terms of people who experience those things based on their race?
I got into this work, Better Together in La Crosse County is a mental health project, a youth mental health project. And I certainly saw, and we see how a sense of belonging is fundamental to our mental health and to our well-being, to our physical health. And so if you are a community member who feels that they don't belong, that they are not welcomed, that because of wearing a hijab or because of the color of their skin, that impacts our mental health. Does that answer your question, Ezra? And I may have missed part of your question.
Yeah, I was just wondering. I was trying to get at like, what are the different ways that someone who's not familiar with considering racism from a public health perspective might recognize those public health impacts in the lives of their neighbors and people in our community. In other words, how are people of color in the La Crosse area, or more broadly throughout the Cooley region, affected from a health perspective? You raised the issue, for instance, of mental health.
I think that is a huge impact, but it's also access to healthy food because of where you live. It's also feeling that you belong in your school by how you are disciplined. And we see in all of our school districts throughout the region, throughout the state, that children of color are disciplined more harshly than white students. And so it impacts their trajectory of their education, which impacts, their economic, their higher education or aspirations. Being, attending school and never seeing someone that looks like you, whether it's in the workforce or that you don't hear positive stories of Black, of African Americans who have succeeded, of Hispanic Americans who have invented things, when your education is only focused on one population, that impacts your health. The microaggressions that Alyssa, was kind of talking about, that impacts you also at a physical level. They might be called micro. They're small. It's a look. It's feeling that someone is following you, and when you walk into a store, or you're ignored when you're trying to ask for help. Those are all micro. Those are not going to cause anyone to go into a deep crisis. But the accumulation of all those experiences impact a person's health.
We're talking about racism as a public health crisis today, and we're also going to be getting some information about upcoming discussions, presentations, including the White Privilege Symposium, which is coming up in December, and that's the subject today on Newsmakers. If you'd like to review part of this episode or listen to one of our previous shows that you might have missed, you can find all of them on our website, which is WPR.org/newsmakers. If you want to get in touch with the show, I would love to hear from you. I'd love to hear what questions you want answered about the things going on in our communities. You can email me at newsmakers@WPR.org. That's newsmakers@WPR.org. Our conversation will continue in just a moment. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios in La Crosse, talking about racism as a public health crisis today. Our guests are Diana Diaz-Granados and Alyssa Gostanczyk, and I'm glad to have them here. And Diana, right before the break, was talking about how different people experience all kinds of what are called microaggressions. But when you're the one experiencing them, little things add up, as they say, and they don't seem so micro when it's this constantly facing these things day after day all through your life. I can't even imagine. Diana, you work with an organization, Better Together, that is working with youth mental health. Youth is a challenging enough time. I don't want to go back there. I'm glad it's over, and it's hard enough to get through that. And imagine, you know, being the only person who looks like you in your class, or one of the only people who looks like you in your school. Talk about how the effects of you know, either overt acts of prejudice, somebody being called a name or handled, you know, differently that way, or even things that aren't intentional, like, you know, always getting side eye as you walk down the hall or something like that. How can that affect the development of the area children?
It impacts their mental health. It impacts their, as I said, their self-confidence, their hopefulness, and what we can see are behaviors that because kids may not know how to react, so they might react in aggressively. They might we certainly have seen that. Trying to take it in, they're trying to just ignore it, and they can act up because of those emotions, that they are tired of being treated as less than.
So I can hear incredulous parents throughout the radio listening audience going, every person is accountable for their own behavior. So just in terms of knowing how to perceive these things. I mean, of course, we're all accountable for our own behavior, but really, can issues like racism and these things that affect the psyche of our children, like, does it really get to that point where these kids are maybe acting almost out of a necessity to react, or maybe in a situation where their psychological well-being is sort of forcing them into some of these negative behaviors that we generally would perceive them as, like, assign it to, like, bad parenting or kids are just being kids or something like that?
That's right. I believe so. I really do. Children, no one is born racist. No one is born with these with racist ideas. Those are things that are learned, and those actions that can start at a very early age are learned behaviors from society, from the media, from now children have to deal with social media in their lives, and I absolutely think that every behavior is a communication. And so whether behaviors that are negative behaviors or withdrawn behaviors or just achievement, lack of can all communicate to us that the system, the education system, is not meeting kids where they're at, or is not meeting their needs, and that we need to look at our schools with an equity lens to see what do we need to provide our school or our children so everyone can succeed.
Alyssa Gostanczyk is with Viterbo and is a committee member with the Waking Up White Steering Committee and is with us today as well. Alyssa, a lot of the students that you see at Viterbo, they've already passed the threshold of childhood, and they're adults technically, college students. But they're still developing as people. They're still processing what has happened to them in their lives, and And, you know, Viterbo is like any other place in La Crosse, mostly white people and fewer people of color. Talk about what you have to do as a higher education institution to make sure that you're working toward a more level playing field.
I think about, Ezra, what you were just saying now about how they are like adults, but are still developing. And a lot of what Diana talked about in terms of that consistent experience at school and the support that they are and are not getting, and how the school experience through middle school and high school and then on to college is continuous, especially in our area with a high population of white educators. And I think when I look at, if we zoom out a little bit, right, and look at Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin COWS, University of Wisconsin Madison COWS group did a 2019 study called Race in the Heartland. And Wisconsin ranks absolute last for eighth grade math scores. Wisconsin has the highest disparity between white student test scores and Black student test scores. And so thinking about an eighth grade, what is that setting you up for? Well, that's setting you up for high school. Wisconsin also has the second worst number of out-of-school suspensions. Black students are 7.5 times more likely than white students to face out-of-school suspension. That happens in middle school, happens in high school. So if school's not a great experience and you're missing a lot of school, how is that setting you up for success in college? Wisconsin also ranks absolute last for bachelor's degrees. Only 14% of Black students hold a bachelor's degree in Wisconsin, while 30% of white student or our white population does. And so I think that those three statistics right there are an excellent example of how eighth grade connects with high school. High school ladders right into college. And so for listeners who have watched the Amplifying the Voices of Black Youth and Their Parents film series, that's been available over the last year that Diana does an absolutely fantastic job facilitating. They will know, especially from that parent section, that the parents in our community, parents of color who went to La Crosse high schools, are saying that this is the same experience I had 30 years ago when I was in school. Nothing has changed. And so to get to your question about how do we instigate that change, I think that it is definitely a two-part piece. And there's definitely more of the lion's share of work on white people and making those environments more welcoming and more accessible to our students of color. And so whether that means being a test optional school like Viterbo is, waiving admission fees, knowing that money may be tight, or maybe applying to multiple schools, that's just to, you know, try to get them in the door. Then when they get on campus, are there students that look like them and are performing well? Are there faculty and staff and administrators that look like them and can relate to their lived experiences? I'm a friendly, personable, welcoming kind of administrative member, but my lived experience as a white woman is so much different than one of our students of color. And so while I may have fantastic intentions, that doesn't mean that I am going to be that welcoming ear that every student of color wants to talk to, right? Folks want to sometimes just talk to somebody who's lived that same experience and is going to listen to them and provide that empathy. And so I think that getting back to the lion's share of work, having the social justice and equity work that Viterbo is doing to try to educate folks around this topic, right? Because you can't understand how something is a problem until you acknowledge that it's a problem. And acknowledging something is a problem through education, whether that is peer or attending an event like the White Privilege Symposium, the National Conference on Race and Ethnicity in Higher Education, just knowing that this is an issue. Viterbo just hired our Chief Equity and Chief Officer of Equity, Diversity and Inclusion earlier this year to show that we are committed to making Viterbo a more welcoming environment and doing the work that's going to allow students of color to want to come here, come and then stay through graduation.
You talked about Alyssa. You talked about white people doing more of the work. That's you know, my shorthand version of one of the things you were talking about, and that's something that I think people are hearing more and more often. As I've repeated on this show, we had a previous guest on this show who is a local activist and a racial justice worker who is black, and he said, look, white people don't need black people's permission to solve racism. You can do it anytime you want to. And that really struck me, you know, not because I never wanted racism to cease to be an issue, but I maybe didn't take enough responsibility for my own role in that. And I think I'm not alone in that. Alyssa, what's that been like to think about not just the existence of racism, but like the responsibility that white people specifically have to eliminate it or to undermine whatever is propping up racist systems?
So I think about how sometimes a common response of white people when a person of color says, hey, this is a problem, a white person may say, well, tell me how to fix it. And the response to that is from the person of color might be, you created this problem. This is not my mess to clean up. This is your mess to clean up. And so I think that looking at it through that lens, that systemic inequities, right, starting with the founding fathers and before that, are primarily have been created and then upheld by white people. And so as a white person being able to hold a position of power, not only the position, I think, but also just the privilege that I have in being able to say, hey, this is a problem, and that being heard differently than if a person of color were to say the exact same thing. And that right there, that cross section of, I can say the exact same thing a person of color says, but if I'm doing this work effectively, I'm not saying that same thing and pretending I came up with the idea. No, I am amplifying the voice of that person of color to say, this is what we're hearing from the communities. This is what we're hearing is going to be helpful. This is the kind of change we need to make. And so that's why I think that this work is so unique in that it's not just people of color in one set, in one circle and white people in another circle trying to do this work independently. It's very group oriented because at some point each of those groups is going to come to a standstill and not be able to move forward because they don't have input from the particular white people not having the input of a person of color. And so I think that's why doing the work in collaboration is really important, so that as white people, we can make sure that the changes that we're making and what we're working towards is actually going to be helpful and doesn't end up being more harmful in the long run. Because I think that there are a lot of white, well-intentioned white people out there, myself included, who come up with an idea or think we know it all. And we're like, oh, we know what the problem is. We'll just go ahead and fix it without even asking the person that is being affected to say, hey, this is an idea we have. Is this going to be helpful? How can we amplify what our friends of color are already saying to continue that work?
So, Alyssa, since you sort of mentioned your being newish to this work when you started working with this committee a couple years ago now, and so I'm wondering if you might have some perspective on this. What you hear from a lot of people is, I know there's still problems here and there that we need to address, but it's by and large better than it used to be, isn't it? And so they use that as a way to sort of question how much racism still exists in society. How do you get past that kind of notion with somebody who just doesn't acknowledge widespread systemic racism because that hasn't been their experience, and so they can't bring themselves to believe that it's true?
I think that piece about just because it has not been your experience doesn't mean that it's not true, right? So to use a very health-oriented experience, just because I haven't had cancer and gone through chemotherapy doesn't mean that I don't acknowledge that cancer and going through chemotherapy is horrendous, right? So I am trusting that person and their shared experience and what they're saying to me, that this is my lived experience, this is what's happening, and you should believe me. And I think that belief too is an important foundation of this work, that it's not saying to that person of color, well, I need you to give me an example of a microaggression, or, you know, I just don't see that way. This person probably didn't mean any harm. That wasn't their intent. Well, it doesn't matter what their intent was. The impact was whatever they said, did, whatever it may be, was harmful. And so I think that as being, like I said, being new to this work, something that I'm continually working through is, as you said, Ezra, knowing that I don't need permission to step in and say something, right? That bystander intervention piece. And it is hard. It's hard every single day. But a person of color doesn't have the option as to whether or not they experience that. And so I need to, as a white person, need to continue to put myself in those situations, work on speaking up, work on educating myself, and not using a lack of knowledge as a way to say, well, I don't feel like I have enough information on this topic, so I'm just not going to speak up quite yet. Right? There are racial scholars who spend their entire life's work on this and still don't know it all. So why would I think that I will eventually reach this epitome of knowledge and then suddenly feel like I can do the work? I think that it's making mistakes, because you're definitely going to make mistakes, which I think is also a very white trait, to not want to make mistakes, not acknowledge those mistakes, and not want to hear or know how to respond to that critical feedback. And so knowing right away, I'm going to screw up and I may do more harm than good sometimes. And then I also want, when that happens, being a strong enough character, strong enough leader to acknowledge that and say, you know what, I'm so sorry. That was not my intent, but it was very clearly my impact. I now understand how that was harmful. I will endeavor to do better in the future. And then also knowing that it's not going to turn out okay always. Like I may have irreparably damaged that relationship, which is something I'm just going to have to live with. I think wanting a nice, neat, happy ending is also a very white trait. And that is not what you get with this work.
That's Alista Gostonczyk. Diana Diaz-Granados is also with us on this conversation. Diana, I'm listening to what Alyssa said about people not liking to make mistakes, and in particular, people don't like to have their mistakes pointed out to them by others, and yet I'm wondering how folks can approach looking at racism in a way that they haven't necessarily had the opportunity to look at it before, without becoming defensive about the way it makes them feel. Because really, like, if I approach a conversation about racism and somebody points out something about me, my behavior, something I said that I didn't know I was saying, or something like that, and then I get defensive about it, I'm really making that about me and not about fixing the problem. So how can people move past whatever they might be feeling about that, or deal with it, or whatever, in order to actually become part of the solution?
Taking a deep breath. I think recognizing, just as you said, Ezra, that it's not about you, that it's important, that this work requires, some special skills that we all need to practice, and such as, listening to others for understanding, not and to resist that temptation to respond or to try to make sense of something just based on your own perspective. It also requires requires everyone to put on a learner's mindset, to recognize there's so much that we need to that we can learn and learn from, but there's also information that we need to unlearn and practices that we need to unlearn. There are words and phrases that need to be retired. And it's each person's responsibility to kind of seek that. That's part of that work, is understanding that Yeah, back in, you know, when I was growing up, it was acceptable to, we said that it, we don't see color, that we, that we wanted to aspire to be a colorblind society. Well, we've now, we recognize that that is not what we should be aspiring to, that that seeing color is normal, seeing color in recognizing the beauty in a person, you know, a person's ethnicity and race is a good thing. It's the hierarchy that that we place on those differences that is racism. And then, and I think we also just need to recognize that that this work is uncomfortable, and that if, you know, hey, it's a, maybe it's a moral kind of decision within yourself that are you willing to make yourself uncomfortable to learn more, listen more, and contribute to making your community a better place for everyone.
That's Diana Diaz-Granados. She's with Better Together in La Crosse County and is a co-leader, part of the co-leadership team of the Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community committee that's been working on these issues the last couple of years in our community. Alyssa Gostanczyk is with us as well. She is with Career Services at Viterbo University and a member of the La Crosse Waking Up White Steering Committee as well. And I'm grateful for both of these people being here to talk about this with us today. We're talking about racism as a public health crisis. If you've missed part of our conversation today, you can find it online, WPR.org/newsmakers. And we're going to wrap up our program right after this by learning about a couple of opportunities that you have to find out more information and participate in some discussions locally about this issue and the broader concept of dismantling racism here in the Cooley region. That's all coming up. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm talking today with Alyssa Gostanczyk, who is the Assistant Director of Internships in the Career Services Department at Viterbo University, and she's also a member of the La Crosse Waking Up White Steering Committee. Diana Diaz-Granados joins us today as well. She is with Better Together in La Crosse County and is a co-team leader of Creating a Healthier Multicultural Community, which is a committee of the aforementioned group that's been doing some very interesting work and planning some very interesting events in our community that are available in a variety of ways, some in person, some online, some hybrid. And we're going to find out about some of those events right now. First of all, the issue we've been talking about today, racism as a public health crisis, is actually the topic of an interesting conversation that's going to be coming up in about a week. Alyssa, what are the details about that about that conversation?
So on Sunday, November 14th at 1 p.m., Dr. Fran Kaplan and Reggie Jackson of Nurturing Diversity Partners are going to be joining us via Zoom, and they're going to be talking a lot about expanding understanding of racism as a social detriment to health locally, regionally, and nationally, examining how successful public health campaigns have made our lives better by moving us beyond longstanding but unhealthy cultural practices, and hopefully increasing audience members' desires for and ability to work towards racial equity in their spheres of influence.
So that's going to be on Sunday, right? The 14th?
Correct.
And how can people find information on that presentation?
There is information on our website, which is laxwakingupwhite.com, under the regional read tab.
Another event that's highlighting this, really it got the whole thing started. The group is even called La Crosse Waking Up White Collaborative, and it was all promoting the regional read of the book Waking Up White by Debbie Irving. And there's going to be an event called the White Privilege Symposium on Friday and Saturday, December 3rd and 4th. Diana, can you tell us a little bit about the White Privilege Symposium and what's going to take place there?
Yes. On Friday, we will have a keynote, a few keynotes from, including the author of the book, Waking of White. We have also Jaziri X and Winona LaDuc that will be speaking. On Friday is the keynote for Debbie Irving. Jaziri X will be on Saturday, and the final keynote is with Winona LaDuc. Those Friday sessions will be open and free to the public. And more information is also on the LAX WakingUpWhite.com.
Very interesting, and that is going to be a great event. And it was delayed due to COVID, and now we're finally able to for it to come to fruition. The multiple years of work now by the steering committee, so that'll be very, very good. There are also a lot of book chats that are going on in the area. I mean, a couple of them that I've written down is, Diana, what you were alluding to earlier, why being colorblind is not a good approach. There are talks on how children learn about race and how adults can help. Talks about stereotypes in the language that we use. Those kinds of things are all available as part of this ongoing series of book chats. Alyssa, tell me about the book chats and tell people where they can find more information about them.
Absolutely. Book chat information is available on that website. Those are free 90-minute small group in-person theme-based facilitated discussions. Having finished the Waking Up White book is not a prerequisite. We're really wanting to get folks in and be talking about these kinds of topics. I also want to highlight the event that you brought up with talking with children and how that is important. I think that that's going to be this coming Saturday, November 6th, with Dr. Erin Winkler, and that one is also available via Zoom at 10:30. In the morning. And I think as a parent, that one is very relevant to me and probably many of our listeners, because if our children of color are not too young to experience racism, then our white children are certainly not too young to learn about it. And so having those conversations early, making it very clear that it's okay to talk about race and to ask questions, just helps to eliminate some of those stigmas that they get as they grow up. And as a parent, I feel that it's my responsibility to teach that to my child, whether they learn it in the classroom or not. There's many other things that kids don't learn in the classroom that parents are responsible for. And so I think this topic is also one of them.
A lot of those conversations are being facilitated with the help of the La Crosse Public Library, and a lot of the information, sign-up information, is available through their website as well. It's been interesting to see so many different parts of the community come together. And Diana, you were mentioning to me during one of the breaks here that all of this is people stepping up to this issue as volunteers. There isn't a lot of funding behind these projects. There's no executive director that's drawing some huge salary for this or anything like that. This is just members of our community working together to make it a better place, isn't it?
It is. And that's what, it's been such gratifying and really life-changing work for me. And I think for really all of us that, we've made new friendships. We've learned a lot. And it's our way to give back to our community, because we love, we love La Crosse. We want this place to be a better, healthier place for everyone. It was started by, a small group of people that read the book Waking Up White and said, we think that our community could benefit from these teachings, from this. And this is just white woman's, perspective, but it's opened the door for more and more discussion. And our LAX Waking Up White website has so many resources for people that, regardless of where they are on this journey, that they can learn from, and ideas for other books, for podcasts to listen to people of color, to books for children, and in addition to all of our events. So it's been a wonderful experience. That I'm really proud to be in our community and being part of it.
Diana Diaz-Granados, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Ezra, for having us.
Alyssa Gostanzik, thank you as well. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ezra.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. My producer is Dawn Jewell. Let me tell you about the opportunities you have to hear our show each week. Of course, we originate Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. Our show repeats Friday evenings at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. If you've got an idea for something we should be covering in the future, or if you're working with an organization that maybe has an event you'd like us to know about, or if you'd like to correspond with us for any reason at all, just drop us a line. Our email is newsmakers@WPR.org. That's newsmakers@WPR.org. Please join us again next week for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.